Well, good evening, little masters, and welcome to episode 207 of the Prancing Pony Podcast, where we can tell a sparrow from a finch a league off.
Okay, speak for yourself. I mean, maybe with a nice pair of binoculars and an illustrated book of bird species.
Well, yeah. I was thinking with my 400 millimeter lens. Yeah, same thing.
Okay, yeah, that. Mm-hmm. Well, folks, go ahead and pull up a bench in the common room. I'm Sean Marchese, the real life Lord of the Mark, and I'm here with the weary man of the West with tinted helm and cloven shield, Alan Sisto.
You finally arrived, Sean. Too little, too late, man.
That's how I usually am.
All right. Folks, today we're going to be talking about the first part of Helm's Deep. Now, that's chapter 7 in book 3 of The Lord of the Rings. And it's when Theoden decides that the Fjords of Isen just aren't such a great place to visit this time of year. Maybe Helm's Deep would be better.
We're just going to reroute just the whole thing. We're just going to go this way instead.
Well, we're already on the road there, right? I mean, it's not that far out of the way.
Yeah, we're just going to turn off. We're going to do we're just going to take the scenic route. That's all.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, for those of you joining us for the first time, welcome. Here at the Prancing Pony Podcast, we are working our way through J.R.R. Tolkien's Legendarium, a few pages at a time.
We study the details, make connections to other writings, talk about our favorite themes.
And we have a lot of fun along the way, so we're glad you've joined us.
And we hope you'll be glad you joined as well.
Indeed. But before we get back to the text, it is time for a Tolkien quote of the day. So in 1971, Tolkien was writing to a correspondent, apparently a Jesuit priest named P. Rourke S.J., who had mentioned the glittering caves that we'll see later in this chapter. Now his response is published as letter number 321 in Carpenter's volume, and Tolkien says in it, "I was most pleased by your reference to the description of glittering caves. No other critic, I think, has picked it out for special mention. It may interest you to know that the passage was based on the caves in Cheddar Gorge, and was written just after I had revisited these in 1940, but was still colored by my memory of them much earlier, before they became so commercialized. I had been there during my honeymoon nearly 30 years before."
Now, Cheddar Gorge is a limestone gorge near a village, not surprisingly, called Cheddar in Somerset, with huge cliffs and caves filled with stalactites and stalagmites, pools, etc. And yes, for those who are wondering, the famous cheese got its name from here. The name comes from an Old English word, cheador, which means deep, dark cavity or pouch. Now, etymology aside, who are we kidding? We never set etymology aside on the show.
What show are you on?
Now, Tolkien's history with the place is short, but clear. Hammond and Skull tell us that Tolkien and Edith visited Cheddar Gorge during their honeymoon at nearby Clevedon in March 1916, and again with most of their children in early April 1940 while on holiday.
It is an absolutely stunning location, just judging from the pictures. I haven't been there in person.
No, I know, but I'd love to go. It'd be a great place
to
see.
The pictures I've seen are amazing. And it's one of the few real world places that Tolkien says directly influenced one of his locations in Middle Earth. Mm-hmm. John Garth actually mentions this in his book, The Worlds of J.R.R. Tolkien, saying that one of the cave complexes that extends more than 2 miles, and I'm quoting from Garth here, was opened up by Richard Gow and his sons from 1892 to 1898. Half a mile of this became a show cave lit by electricity with areas dubbed the Swiss Village, St. Paul's, Solomon's Temple, and Aladdin's Cave. Sounds like a 19th century Disneyland.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
It does. Back to Garth. Visiting on their honeymoon in 1916, Tolkien and Edith probably saw this in the neighboring Cox's Cave.
Now, Garth goes on to suggest that they may also have inspired the Thousand Caves of Menegroth as well, before observing that by proxy through Aglarond, the caves of Cheddar awake the poet in the taciturn Gimli as he evokes the colors, the crystals, the columns, the fluted forms and endless avenues, the mirrored images of many pinnacles. And then he quotes Gimli from The Lord of the Rings, "And plink, a silver drop falls, and the round wrinkles in the glass make all the towers bend and waver like weeds and corals in a grotto of the sea." Boy, that doesn't sound like the normal Gimli, does it?
That does not sound like Gimli at all. It's much more beautiful than any of the poetry that I've ever written about the cheese of Cheddar.
Well, and you've written poetry about the cheddar.
I have. I've sung songs about cheddar cheese while I'm...
It's worth it, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, it's worth mentioning that the commercialization that Tolkien was talking about in his "I was there before it was cool" comment is something that Garth sheds a little light on. Garth says that by the 1930s, the owner of both Gow's Cave and Cox's Cave had installed new visitor buildings and was advertising the place as a tourist destination in Paris and New York. By 1936, Garth says, visitors had soared by more than one-third, to 273,000.
That's pretty impressive, because that was right after the fire they had there, you know.
Oh, there's a fire?
Yeah, it was the fire, because after the fire, that's when they figured out they could make smoked cheddar. Sorry. I'm so sorry. Okay. Moving on.
The Gow family's industrious excavations, and the later commercialization, of which Tolkien complained in his letter, seemed to color Legolas's rather knee-jerk response to Gimli's effusions. With a typically elven perception of dwarves as greedy materialists, he warns his friend not to tell his dwarven kinsfolk, because one family of busy dwarves with hammer and chisel might mar more than they made. Oh, Legolas. Still not quite relieved of all his old prejudices.
Nope.
But I suppose he's getting there. And he will make more progress by going into battle with a dwarf. So let's not delay starting this chapter any longer, shall we? Alan, why don't you go ahead and get us started on the road to the Isin?
The sun was already westering as they rode from Edoras, and the light of it was in their eyes, turning all the rolling fields of Rohan to a golden haze. There was a beaten way northwestward along the foothills of the White Mountains, and this they followed, up and down in a green country, crossing small, swift streams by many fords. Far ahead and to their right, the misty mountains loomed. Ever darker and taller they grew as the miles went by. The sun went slowly down before them. Evening came behind. The host rode on. Need drove them. Fearing to come too late, they rode with all the speed they could, pausing seldom. Swift and enduring were the steeds of Rohan, but there were many leagues to go. 40 leagues and more it was, as a bird flies, from Edoras to the fords of the Isin, where they hoped to find the king's men that held back the hosts of Saruman. Night closed about them. At last they halted to make their camp. They had ridden for some 5 hours and were far out upon the western plain, yet more than half their journey lay still before them. In a great circle, under the starry sky and the waxing moon, they now made their bivouac. They lit no fires, for they were uncertain of events, but they set a ring of mounted guards about them, and scouts rode out far ahead, passing like shadows in the folds of the land.
All right. Seems a good place to stop and
indeed
talk about some of this.
That's what we do. That's the whole point of the show,
right?
It is what we do. So at least it's what we claim to do, so we probably should do it.
Yeah. Probably should get started. All right. So, it's worth pointing out, especially for those of us who've watched the films a bunch of times, that they're not actually marching to Helm's Deep. They're actually on their way to Isengard. That was their original purpose in leaving Edoras.
Yeah. They weren't going to Helm's Deep yet. In fact, it'll be a little while before they decide that's where they're going. Mm-hmm. Now, we know from the last chapter, they headed out a little after 2 p.m., right? That was when they had to have all the men gathered. It was 2 hours after the noon. So it is the afternoon. Sun's already in the west and starting to set. And they follow this path along the foothills. They're crossing streams. And they're nearing the Misty Mountains, at least, you know, west-east they're approaching the Misty Mountains.
Right. But when evening comes, they have to keep going.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, need drove them. They know that they've got short time here.
Time is of the essence. That's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's a long way, too. It's 40 leagues from Edoras to the fords of Isin. Now, 40 leagues, just a reminder, in Tolkien, the leagues are 3 miles. So that's 120 miles or 190 kilometers. It's a long way.
It is. Now, they're riding for 5 hours, so it's around 7 p.m.
Right.
When they stop. And so night has fallen at this point. But they're still not even halfway, are they?
That's right. Skeem says that they've ridden 50 miles, which leaves them 70 to go the next day.
Mm-hmm. So they camp, but this is not like a nice, comfortable camp with tents and covers. This is a bivouac, which is exactly the opposite. It's a camp without tents and covers.
Yeah, they're just sleeping on the ground, right?
Yeah, but they just set a ring of guards around them and have some scouts riding out.
Scouts. That's something that maybe Saruman, that incredible general, should have employed, as we'll see. Yeah. Oh, we're going to be chatting about Saruman's tactical and strategic skills. Yes, we will.
We've got some. Oh, we found some fantastic stuff on that. I can't wait.
Oh, we did. That's going to be so fun.
I got to wait. We'll get to it in due time. But
seriously,
yeah, it's great stuff.
Well, and then we do read that they leave within an hour of sunrise. So they get up, you know, and get going right away.
Right.
And shortly after that is where I'm going to have you pick up.
Okay. Well, I'm going to be starting right in, well, not in the middle of a sentence, but I'm going to be starting
pretty much
the second word of a sentence, because that's
what
that's
I
the passage
made you
my
do.
Co-host has assigned me tonight. So I don't even, for people reading along with us, I don't even know where to tell them to look.
That's a very good point. About halfway through the paragraph.
Halfway through the paragraph, you'll see a sentence begin with "and." And yeah. I'm going to start with the next word. Away in the northwest, there seemed to be another darkness brooding about the feet of the Misty Mountains, a shadow that crept down slowly from the Wizard's Veil. Gandalf dropped back to where Legolas rode beside Éomer.
"You have the keen eyes of your fair kindred, Legolas," he said, "and they can tell a sparrow from a finch a league off. Tell me, can you see anything away yonder towards Isengard?"
"Many miles lie between," said Legolas, gazing thither and shading his eyes with his long hand. "I can see a darkness. There are shapes moving in it, great shapes far away upon the bank of the river, but what they are I cannot tell. It is not mist or cloud that defeats my eyes. There is a veiling shadow that some power lays upon the land, and it marches slowly downstream. It is as if the twilight under endless trees were flowing downwards from the hills."
"And behind us comes a very storm of Mordor," said Gandalf. "It will be a black night."
But not the Black Knight.
No, because the Black Knight always triumphs.
None shall pass. Yeah, so with the rising sun comes this growing darkness, like a storm in the east. So we know that there's this storm coming from Mordor that Gandalf mentions at the end of the passage. But then there's this other shadow in the north, huh, coming from Isengard.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So Gandalf asks Legolas, you know,
yeah,
what does everybody always ask Legolas? What do your elf eyes see? Or something to that effect.
Because my human eyes don't see anything.
Even his Ainu eyes don't see anything, apparently.
Oh, no, I know.
So Legolas, of course, rubbing it in, is like, well, many miles lie between, but here's all the things I can see.
Right, ooh. That's right. Well, when he says many miles lie between, let's be clear. Isengard is about 30 miles or so north of the Fords, and we're still 60 miles west of the Fords. Now, if it were a right triangle, and it's not, it's actually a little bit of an obtuse triangle, so it's even further. But if it were a right triangle, the hypotenuse of that triangle would be about 67 miles. So I'm going to call it 70 to 75 miles. And yeah, because I'm a nitpicker this way, this is another example.
You always do this. You always do this. Do it.
Legolas would have to be more than 3,000 feet above the ground in order to see anything 75 miles away.
Fine. Fine.
Oh, man.
Maybe elves can see along the straight road. I don't know.
Through the ground.
Through the ground. Maybe. Well, Legolas, regardless of the physics of the thing, sees the darkness with moving shapes. And I think these moving shapes might be Ents and Horns. What do you think?
I think so. And they are.
Okay. Spoiler. We'll get there. It's not that he can't see because of the mist, right? He sees this veiling shadow, this twilight under endless trees.
I think he can't see because it's 75 miles, but yeah.
Stop. Stop it.
Okay.
But no, you're right. It is absolutely Ents and Huorns that Legolas is seeing. Scheme actually confirms this, although it says that it's Gandalf that sees this, but says it's explicitly the shadow of Huorns.
That's right. Well, he does notice something, right? He's the one who observes it first and then asks Legolas for details. But yeah, Scheme suggests that Gandalf actually knows what it is. Mm. And then, of course, we get that observation about, well, in front of us is that, but behind us is this storm of Mordor.
And here I am stuck in the middle with you.
That's right. But behind that very storm of Mordor, that's our inaugural PPP moot. It's going to be here before you know it, folks. In less than 2 weeks, which means you'll only have to put up with those terrible jokes during the transition for two more weeks. It's going to run from May 14th to 16th, and you're going to want to visit our website, theprancingponypodcast.com, for more information and to register before it's too late.
We're really excited about this. I know we've been saying this for several weeks now, but it's only because it's true, and we really want you all to join us. One of our keynote speakers is going to be Dr. Amy Sturgis. Now, she's taught courses on everything from Tolkien and Harry Potter to Star Wars and Star Trek, and she's an awesome speaker. We saw her at last year's MythMoot, and we are looking forward to having her join us.
Now, our other keynote speaker is Dr. Michael Drought, who joined us here on the Prancing Pony podcast all the way back in episode 66. He is the editor for the J.R.R. Tolkien Encyclopedia and a co-editor for the journal Tolkien Studies. He's been involved with LOTRO and so much more. And we are thrilled to have him join us as well. And we have a surprise last-minute guest to tell you about. Dr. Tom Shippey will also be joining us.
Oh, it's going to be so great. We are both so happy to have such a lineup of speakers for this event.
Really, yeah.
And you folks are really just going to love it. Now, the theme of the first PPP Moot is digital recovery. It's all about the many ways we find fairy online and regain a clear view from virtual communities and online fandom. Now, in addition to our special guest speakers, we've got a full slate of presentations. We've got a lot of fun social events planned. We've got a pub quiz coming. We've got a live AMA-style episode recording with me and Alan. So please, plan on joining us.
Yeah, and you know what we won't have, by the way, just to make this really clear? We will not have any Tom Shippey impressions. I'm not going to do that.
No, please don't.
I don't know. Maybe late Friday night I'll pull that off. Maybe, because he won't be with us, but we'll see. All right. Now, our event pages are up and running, so you can look at the schedule, check out our speakers, and of course, most importantly, register to attend the three-day event. Registrations are going to end soon. We've worked hard to make the Moot as accessible to as many people as possible, both in terms of time zones and cost. It's only $35 for the whole weekend, so go to theprancingponypodcast.com and sign up today.
Now, of course, you're going to want to check out the rest of the website as well while you're there. We still have all the rest of the good stuff there, from show notes to outtakes to our Prancing Pony Ponderings, our online storefront where you can get PPP shirts and mugs and stickers and even more.
And one of the best resources we have is our library. Our web guru, Phil Dean, has worked hard on redesigning the library this season, and it shows. As you know, we love the books here at the Prancing Pony Podcast, and we want to make sure you can get your hands on any of the books that we mention here.
That's right. We talk about a lot of Tolkien-related stuff on the podcast, but really, Alan and I are fans of Tolkien's books and books about Tolkien. That's why we have the library page with links to every book we've mentioned on the show.
Now, we do make a few pennies from the purchases you make from those links, so thank you for your support.
All right. Well, with that, why don't we go ahead and pick up with the storm coming?
All right. That's what we'll do then. As the second day of their riding drew on, the heaviness in the air increased. In the afternoon, the dark clouds began to overtake them, a somber canopy with great billowing edges flecked with dazzling light. The sun went down, blood red in a smoking haze. The spears of the riders were tipped with fire as the last shafts of light kindled the steep faces of the peaks of Þríhyrn. Now very near they stood on the northernmost arm of the White Mountains, three jagged horns staring at the sunset. In the last red glow, men in the vanguard saw a black speck, a horseman riding back towards them. They halted, awaiting him. He came, a weary man with dinted helm and cloven shield. Slowly he climbed from his horse and stood there a while, gasping. At length he spoke.
"Is Eomer here?" he asked. "You come at last, but too late, and with too little strength. Things have gone evilly since Théodred fell. We were driven back yesterday over the Isen with great loss. Many perished at the crossing. Then at night fresh forces came over the river against our camp. All Isengard must be emptied, and Saruman has armed the wild hillmen and herd folk of Dunland beyond the rivers. These also he loosed upon us. We were overmastered. The shield wall was broken. Erkenbrand of Westfold has drawn off those men he could gather towards his fastness in Helm's Deep. The rest are scattered. Where is Eomer? Tell him there is no hope ahead. He should return to Edoras before the wolves of Isengard come there."
Théoden had sat silent, hidden from the man's sight behind his guards. Now he urged his horse forward.
"Come, stand before me, Cheol," he said. "I am here. The last host of the Aerolingus has ridden forth. It will not return without battle."
Oh, man.
No, it won't. No, it won't. What a moment that must be for Cheol. But we'll get to that.
Yeah, we will.
All right.
That moment when you realize Théoden's there and,
the king.
All right. Well, going back to the beginning of the passage that you just read, the storm actually catches up to them right as their second day of riding out from Edoras comes to a close. And this is March 3rd.
That's right. And I just want to spend some time enjoying the visuals of this scene, right? The dark clouds, the somber canopy, the edges flicked with light. This is an amazing description, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah. The sun went down blood red in a smoking haze. Oh, it's gorgeous.
And the spears tipped with fire.
Yeah.
Gorgeous. Just gorgeous. I want to see a really good illustration of this moment.
That would be really cool. I can't think of one off the top of my head.
I can't either. But the idea of the spears being tipped with fire and this you know, sunset and sort of the edges of the clouds being lit up by that.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, have we identified the Three Heron before?
I don't know that we have.
I don't think we have, because I don't think we've actually seen this name before. I mean, the name just means three horns in Old English. Well,
Rohirric.
Rohirric.
But they're the three northernmost peaks of the White Mountains.
Because the White Mountains, you know, they're primarily an east-west range, but they sort of, really, they start out kind of heading to the northeast, and then they curve back down to towards the southeast. And where that kind of northerly bend is the narrowest part of the Gap of Rohan, right?
Right, right. That's right. So then we get the arrival of the Weary Man.
The Weary Man. So even before he speaks, really, his appearance tells a story, doesn't it? He's got the dented helm.
It really does, yeah.
Yeah, the cloven shield.
This guy has been through battle.
Yeah, and not on the winning side.
Not on the winning side. He's survived, but he's had a rough time. Yeah,
he really has. And immediately he asks for Éomer, which I love. He's looking for, you know, the highest ranking person here, and he assumes rightly that Éomer would be with this group. And he begins telling his tale without actually waiting for Éomer, which is interesting.
Right. Is Éomer here? Let me just tell you what happened.
Yeah, exactly. Éomer, where are you? By the way, we got our butts kicked. And
the text doesn't really tell us this, but I mean, he's got to be quite emotional at this point, right?
Oh,
I mean,
he's seen so many of his people die, I'm sure.
He could be, you know, one of only a few survivors.
That's correct.
And he's come upon allies, and he's excited, and he's also exhausted, you know?
Yeah. So. And he wants to give them the news to make the decisions that they need to make, which in his mind, of course, is to turn around and go back to Edoras.
Right. And he wants to tell them as quickly as possible, because he already tells them, like, hey, it's great that you're here, but it's already too late.
Yeah.
And there aren't enough of you.
No.
You know, and he goes on to tell them about how, you know, after the death of Théodred, how poorly things have gone. And that's a reference to the first battle of the Fords of Isen, which would have happened just about a week ago, February 25th.
Yeah. What, 8 days, right? February 25th. Yeah. So he explains, look, we lost the fords, and then we were attacked again at night, not just the Uruk-hai, but with the Dunlendings as well, both the Wild Hillmen and the Herd Folk.
Right. Have we done word nerdery on the Dunlendings before? Or Dunlendings?
Not yet. And we're going to do some more in-depth work on the Dunlendings in the third episode here on Helm's Deep, when we kind of get to their motivations. Yeah.
Maybe we'll save that until next time.
Sorry, I said the word motivations, which immediately brings in what scene from Galaxy Quest? That's right.
What is its motivation?
Motivation. Well, that was always your problem. You never took the craft seriously.
All right. Well, remind me to do some Dunland word nerdery when we get to that in a future episode.
Yeah, definitely. We will.
But for now.
Well, how about word nerdery on overmastered?
I was going to get to that. Yeah. So he tells that they were overmastered, which basically means exactly what it sounds like. It means they were mastered completely.
Right. Right. They were not just beaten. They were beaten soundly.
They were thoroughly beaten.
Thrashed.
Completely beaten.
Yeah.
And he mentions the shield wall was broken.
Yeah.
I feel like we need to discuss that a little bit for folks who may not be familiar with it.
I think so.
Alan, you got something on that?
I do. Hammond and Skull reference Evie Gordon's notes from his edition of The Battle of Maldon, which, of course, we referenced just, what, last week,
few
week
episodes
before
ago.
With Tolkien Reading Day.
Yeah.
And so we're going to quote from that rather than the TV show Vikings, which is also an option. A shield wall was a defensive formation made by ranks of men placed closely one behind another and holding their shields side by side and overlapping so as to present a continuous wall. The front rank of men held their shields before their breasts, and the ranks behind held theirs over their heads to protect both those in front and themselves. This formation was probably from common Germanic tradition. Now, as Hammond and Skull then point out, as a primarily cavalry force, the Rohirrim are not like the Anglo-Saxons, but when they fight on foot, they use Anglo-Saxon tactics.
Which makes perfect sense. And we do see that they do have infantry. They're not exclusively a cavalry force. So it makes sense that they would use these Anglo-Saxon infantry tactics when fighting on foot.
Right.
Now,
right.
The tactic itself actually goes back much further than the early Middle Ages even. Even ancient armies like the Greek phalanxes and the Roman legions had similar techniques. But the thing about the shield wall is that when it's broken, This is a really bad thing because
very bad, yeah.
Because the men fighting are relying on the protection provided by the shields of the guys next to them. So once the shield wall is broken, they no longer have the protection that's provided by the fighters around them.
That's right.
Now, a smaller shield wall force might have been able to overcome a larger disorganized force, but once the shield wall is broken, it is going to struggle a lot.
Oh, yeah. very much so. So then Cheoril tells us what happened with at least some of the survivors. He says that some of them were gathered by Erkenbrand and taken to Helm's Deep, which is good.
I'm sorry, I have more word nerdery here.
Okay.
On Erkenbrand.
Why would you apologize for having word nerdery?
I don't know. I feel like I keep on interrupting the flow of the conversation.
We're 207 episodes in, Sean. You don't need to apologize for
word nerdery. It's like there's so much old English here. I feel like I just want to do word nerdery on every single name.
Yeah, that's about right. What do we call it? Lightning word nerdery? Yeah.
Rapid fire, I think, was the word.
That's what it was. Yeah. Rapid fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Hammond and Skull actually pointed me to this one. Erkenbrand may be derived from Old English Erkan, which means precious. And we see that in the Arkenstone, which actually a derivative of Erkenstan in Old English.
That's right.
So Erkan, precious, and then Old English brand, firebrand or torch, which is also a metaphor for a sword.
Right. So going back to what happened with these guys, some were gathered by Erkenbrand and taken to Helm's Deep, but others are scattered. So our forces are really the ones that aren't dead.
Right.
You know, gone to hither, thither, and yon. Yeah.
Right. So he asks again for Éomer and says, like, look, there's no hope ahead. Just go back to Edoras, protect the capital before the wolves get there.
Yeah, protect the king, because he doesn't realize the king's there, as we'll get to that. But
yeah, it's true, yeah.
So let's talk a little while about the news that this man is bringing. News about the defeat of the Rohirrim at what is known as the Second Battle of the Fords of Isen. And when I say talk a while, I mean read some passages from Unfinished Tales to give you the backstory. So a little bit of a long sidebar here.
That's what we do.
That is.
All right, well, first, in that section of Unfinished Tales, we're told that we don't have very clear accounts like we do for the first battle because of all the important things that followed. But we do have plenty of information to go on, and we're going to start with who's in charge. The text says that Erkenbrand of Westfold assumed command of the Westmark when news of the fall of Theodred reached him in the Hornburg on the next day.
Mm-hmm.
He sent errand riders to Edoras to announce this and to bear to Theoden his son's last words, adding his own prayer that Éomer should be sent at once with all help that could be spared. Well, that certainly explains why the weary man is looking for Éomer, doesn't it?
Right. If the errand riders said to send Éomer, he's assuming that this is Éomer.
He must be here. Going back to the text, let the defense of Edoras be made here in the west, he said, and not wait till it is itself besieged.
Hmm.
But Grima used the curtness of this advice to further his policy of delay. It was not until his defeat by Gandalf that any action was taken. The reinforcements with Éomer and the king himself set out in the afternoon of March the 2nd. But that night, the Second Battle of the Fords was fought and lost, and the invasion of Rohan began.
That night. And I think that really shows the deadly impact of Wormtongue, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If Théoden hadn't been under his influence and had left with Éomer and 1,000 cavalry when he got the message, which a footnote to this passage says was February 27th, 5 days earlier, the battle might have turned out very differently indeed.
Yeah.
But let's take a look at Erkenbrand's leadership then. So first, he's at Helm's Deep when he receives the news and assumes command. He does not immediately leave for the Fords because he doesn't know how bad the losses are, nor how many forces he can gather together quickly. He does the right thing. He spends the next 3 days preparing the Hornburg for a defense and then gathering his men. Then the text tells us, the command in the field he gave to Grimbold until he could come himself, but he assumed no command over Elfhelm and his riders, who belonged to the muster of Edoras. The two commanders were, however, friends, and both loyal and wise men, and there was no dissension between them. The ordering of their forces was a compromise between their differing opinions. Elfhelm held that the fords were no longer important, but rather a snare to entrap men better placed elsewhere, since Saruman could clearly send forces down either side of the Isen as suited his purpose. And his immediate purpose would undoubtedly be to overrun Westfold and invest the Hornburg before any effective help could come from Edoras.
So he actually wanted to abandon the fords and put men on foot on the east side of the Isen to hold up the enemy's advance, and then the cavalry to the east of that so they could flank them and drive them into the river.
Yeah.
But Grimbold didn't want to give up the fords. Going to the text again, we do not know, he said, what force Saruman has still at his command. But if it is indeed his purpose to ravage Westfold and drive its defenders into Helm's Deep and there contain them, then it must be very great. He is unlikely to display it all at once. As soon as he guesses or discovers how we have disposed our defense, he will certainly send great strength at all speed down the road from Isengard, and crossing the undefended fords, come in our rear, if we are all gathered northwards.
So they compromised. Grimbold put most of his forces on the west side of the fords, while he and his cavalry stayed on the east bank. The text tells us that the Aeot he left bare, but the footnote to that little bit is just too cool to pass up. It is told that he set up on stakes all about the Aeot, the heads of the axemen that had been slain there. Mm. But above the hasty mound of Theodred in the middle was set his banner. That will be defense enough, he said. Now, those were the orc men, the half-orc axemen that had charged into Theodred's guard and eventually killed him.
Right. Now, in the meantime, Elfhelm took that position on the east side of the river, north of the fords.
Right.
But, quoting from the text again, all went ill, as most likely it would have done in any case. Saruman's strength was too great. He began his attack by day, and before noon of March the 2nd, a strong force of his best fighters, coming down by the road from Isengard, attacked the forts on the west of the fords. This force was, in fact, only a small part of those that he had in hand, no more than he deemed sufficient to dispose of the weakened defense. But the garrison of the fords, though greatly outnumbered, resisted stubbornly. At length, however, when both the forts were heavily engaged, a troop of Uruks forced the passage between them and began to cross the fords. Grimbold, trusting in Elfhelm to hold off attack on the east side, came across with all the men he had left and flung them back, for a while. But the enemy commander then threw in a battalion that had not been committed and broke the defenses. Grimbold was obliged to withdraw across the Isen.
Well, later that night, they sent errand riders to Erkenbrand in Helm's Deep and to Edoras, but they knew that if help didn't come soon, and in great numbers, the best they could hope for was to hold up Saruman's advance before they were overwhelmed. Basically become a speed bump.
Yeah.
But this was Grimbold's doing, and he was, if you remember, the one put in charge by Erkenbrand. A footnote tells us something we should have guessed from earlier, that Elfhelm would then have abandoned the fords at night and headed south to meet Erkenbrand and prepare the defense of the Hornburg. But it all went pear-shaped not much later, as it turns out. It was not yet midnight when points of red light were seen coming from the north and already drawing near on the west of the river. It was the vanguard of the whole remaining forces of Saruman that he was now committing to battle for the conquest of Westfold. They came on at great speed, and suddenly all the host burst into flame, as it seemed. Hundreds of torches were kindled from those borne by the leaders of troops, and gathering into their stream the forces already manning the west bank, they swept over the fords like a river of fire with a great clamor of hate.
Now, it turns out that this was the army that Merry saw leaving Isengard. Later, when he's retelling the story to Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli, he'll relate that he saw the enemy go, endless lines of marching orcs, and troops of them mounted on great wolves. And there were battalions of men, too. Many of them carried torches, and in the flare I could see their faces. They took an hour to pass out of the gates. An hour to pass out of the gates. That's a big force.
That is
right?
A huge force. Unless they're like going really slowly.
Right. Yeah. I don't think they're tiptoeing here.
I don't think this is parade march. Right.
Yeah. This is a big, big force.
Very big force.
So they're crossing the ford with torches. You'd think then would be a perfect time for target practice for the archers, right? Bright lights in the darkness. But the text tells us that Grimbold had only a handful of archers and knew he couldn't hold the east side of the river. Instead, he pulls back and he forms a shield wall around his camp. Quoting from the text again, soon it was surrounded, and the attackers cast torches among them, and some they sent high over the heads of the shield wall, hoping to kindle fires among the stores and terrify such horses as Grimbold still had. But the shield wall held. Then, since the orcs were of less avail in such fighting because of their stature, fierce companies of the Dunlandish hillmen were thrown against it. But for all their hatred, the Dunlandings were still afraid of the Rohirrim if they met face to face, and they were also less skilled in warfare and less well armed. The shield wall still held.
Yes, it did. Well, the shield wall may have held, but he knew it wasn't going to hold forever, and no help was coming from Elfhelm, so he decided to carry out Plan B. Now, he knew that while his men would fight to the death, that wouldn't help Erkenbrand. Arranging a breakout, on the other hand, would be helpful. So when the assault lessened, he, and I'm quoting now from the text again, at once mounted those riders for whom horses were available, not many more than half an Eored, and placed them under the command of Dunhair. The shield wall was opened on the east side, and the riders passed through, driving back their assailants on that side. Then, dividing and wheeling round, they charged the enemy to the north and south of the camp. The sudden maneuver was, for a space, successful. The enemy was confused and dismayed. Many thought at first that a large force of riders had come from the east. Grimbold himself remained on foot with a rear guard of picked men already chosen, and covered for the moment by these and the riders under Dunhair, the remainder retreated with what speed they could. But Saruman's commander soon perceived that the shield wall was broken and the defenders in flight.
Saruman's commander didn't chase after them, though. The fords were captured, and it was time to head south towards Helm's Deep. But in the meantime, the text tells us that the greater part of Grimbold's men survived. But why didn't Elfhelm help out? Well, he was kind of busy.
You could say that, yeah.
The text also tells us more than half of Saruman's force had actually been sent down east of Isen. They came on more slowly than the Western Division, for the land was rougher and without roads, and they bore no lights. But before them, swift and silent, went several troops of the dreaded Wolf Riders. Before Elfhelm had any warning of the approach of enemies on his side of the river, the Wolf Riders were between him and Grimbold's camp, and they were also attempting to surround each of his small groups of riders. It was dark, and all his force was in disarray. He gathered all that he could into a close body of horsemen, but he was obliged to retreat eastward. He could not reach Grimbold, though he knew that he was in straits and had been about to come to his aid when attacked by the Wolf Riders.
And here the text ties in closely with what we're reading in the chapter, that Gandalf received news of the disaster only in the late afternoon of March the 3rd. That's the moment we just read. Now, the king was then at a point not far east of the junction of the road with the branch going to the Hornburg. From there, it was about 90 miles in a direct line to Isengard. Gandalf must have ridden there with the greatest speed that Shadowfax could command. He reached Isengard in the early darkness and left again in no more than 20 minutes, both on the outward journey, when his direct route would take him close to the fords, and on his return south to find Erkenbrand, he must have met Grimbold and Elfhelm. They were convinced that he was acting for the king. We'll talk about one of the reasons shortly. And they took as orders the advice that he gave.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is quite a side story that we don't even see here.
I know, isn't it?
The Rings.
Ah, just tremendous.
And this whole battle, this second battle of the Fords of Isen, happened yesterday.
Yeah.
Last night.
If they had come out into Elm, if they had not listened to Wormtongue.
Yeah.
It's a whole different story. And we'll get to some of the tactical errors that the orcs made, because they really should have done some other things here. They could have really defeated Rohan.
There were so many opportunities.
So many opportunities.
So many wasted opportunities for Saruman. Yeah.
Not much of a general, I have to say.
He's not the great leader of men or orcs that he thinks he is.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I know how to build mechanical things. I'm a really good engineer, and I can make bombs.
Oh, you don't know what a bomb is? Don't worry, I'll show you.
That's right. I've got gunpowder. I'm really good at building things, so I must be pretty good at doing this war thing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, not quite.
But I just think it's really fascinating to think about the fact that, you know, this man, who we'll talk about in just a moment again, that he's just escaped from this battle just within the last, you know, less than 24 hours.
Right. Probably less than a dozen hours at this point.
Could be, yeah. So, well, yeah, this is...
No, you're right. I mean, he would have gotten out. It would have been after midnight.
It's nighttime, yeah. So still, it's less than a day.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing.
Absolutely. Really is. So I'm going to go back to the text, most of which I didn't read. We get to the point where Theoden reveals himself, which is great. And I really do wish I could have read all that. Well, I read at least the initial reveal, but we didn't get to read the rest of it.
Yeah, no, this reaction from the man is pretty amazing, actually. Just the way his face lightens when he sees that Théoden's there.
That's great.
But let's talk a little bit more about what little we know about this man. Because at first glance, it's not really clear whether Cheryl is or is not his name, right?
Right, right.
I mean, the Oxford English Dictionary says that in Old English, it's a word that simply means a man simply without rank, a member of the third or lowest rank of freemen. It's basically the ancestor of the modern word churl, which now is an insult for a rude person, as in churlish behavior. But it didn't always mean that. It just meant a common man without rank.
Right. And, you know, I didn't necessarily think that Théoden knew this guy personally. Oh, hey, Cheryl, what's up, man?
Right.
You know? So it was a little bit of a surprise to find out that it's his name, but it really is, because in the Battles of the Fords of Isen in Unfinished Tales, we read that Grimbold and Elfhelm, two Rohirric leaders that Gandalf encountered on his ride to and from Isengard, were convinced Gandalf, quote, was acting for the king, not only by his appearance on Shadowfax, but also by his knowledge of the name of the errand rider, Cheorl.
Right. And in a footnote to that section, Christopher says about this information that the news was brought by the rider named Cheorl.
Right.
Who, returning from the Fords, fell in with Gandalf, Théoden, and Éomer.
So maybe it is really his name. Maybe it's even the old English equivalent of the modern last name Freeman.
Yeah, or Franklin, which actually had a similar meaning.
Yeah, it's true.
But, you know, Tolkien does this a couple of times. We'll actually see another character later in this chapter who has a name that is oddly literal for the person he is.
Very oddly literal. You're right.
But we'll get to him soon.
We will.
So Théoden tells Cheryl that this is the last host and it will fight.
Yeah.
And again, as we were talking about, you know, Cheryl is just, he's so surprised. He's just delighted to see Théoden here. Mm-hmm. He responds exactly as we would expect for the subject of a king like we know Théoden is.
Oh, yeah.
His face lightens with joy. He kneels. He offers his sword. Command me, Lord, he says.
Yeah, I love that.
Pretty powerful stuff. It shows the love that Théoden's men have for him.
Absolutely.
And how happy they are to see him out and about again.
Oh, I know. And Théoden's mention of the west wind that has shaken the boughs, that is a wonderfully clear reference to Gandalf. I love that moment. And then, of course, he says, let's give this guy a fresh horse. That interests me, though. Do they have spares? Or does the exhausted horse have to go to another rider? How does that work, I wonder? I mean, do they travel with spares? I kind of think they must in case of injuries or loss in battle.
Yeah, they probably do travel with spares. Knowing that they're a cavalry force,
yeah,
they probably need to have spare horses because there could be
That's true.
A battle. There could be a case where a horse is injured, but the rider is fine. So they need a horse
right.
for that rider. So
yeah, so they probably do have some extra horses. That makes sense. All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and have you pick up right after that when Gandalf takes off.
All right. While Théoden was speaking, Gandalf rode a short way ahead, and he sat there alone, gazing north to Isengard and west to the setting sun. Now he came back.
"Ride, Théoden," he said. "Ride to Helm's Deep. Go not to the fords of Isen, and do not tarry in the plain. I must leave you for a while. Shadowfax must bear me now on a swift errand."
Turning to Aragorn and Éomer, and the men of the king's household, he cried,
"Keep well the Lord of the Mark till I return. Await me at Helm's Gate. Farewell."
He spoke a word to Shadowfax, and like an arrow from the bow, the great horse sprang away. Even as they looked, he was gone, a flash of silver in the sunset, a wind over the grass, a shadow that fled and passed from sight. Snowmane snorted and reared, eager to follow, but only a swift bird on the wing could have overtaken him.
"What does that mean?" said one of the guard to Hama.
"That Gandalf Greyhelm has need of haste," answered Hama. "Ever he goes and comes unlooked for."
"Wormtongue, were he here, would not find it hard to explain," said the other.
"True enough," said Hama. "But for myself, I will wait until I see Gandalf again."
"Maybe you will wait long," said the other.
That's an interesting little reveal. We'll talk about that. Let's go back, though, to the beginning of your passage. So Gandalf pulls ahead while this conversation's taking place, and he gets as close a look as he can before the sun completely sets, right?
Yeah. And he comes back with pretty definitive counsel here.
Oh, yes.
Like, it's not like, you know what? I think we might try plan B here. He's like, no, dude, do not go to the fords. Do not tarry in the plain. Do not collect $200.
Yeah, exactly.
Go directly to Helm's Deep.
Yeah.
Stay there for three turns until you roll doubles.
That's right.
And so now they have a new objective, right?
Yeah.
This is where it shifts from, okay, we're going to Isen to we're going to Helm's Deep.
That's right. The battle is no longer going to be at the fords. Now we know where it's going to be, and we need to get to a place that we can defend. And then Gandalf says he has a swift errand, which it presumably isn't Costco because that's never swift. Sorry.
I'm imagining Gandalf coming back with, like, you know, cases of toilet paper
right,
for Helm's
exactly.
Deep.
Yeah. Man, it took me forever to get this stuff.
Just like a pallet of beef jerky.
Oh, that sounds good. I could go for that.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, I know.
Maybe not a whole palette, but
no. And the ones they have there, that's my backup brand. It's not the best stuff, but
really, I like the stuff they have there.
Yeah, it's good. The Pacific Gold.
Yeah,
that's my second choice. That's what
I do have other favorites though.
When I run out of the other one that I like. So anyway,
This episode of the Prancing Pony Podcast brought to you by Alan's favorite beef jerky,
yeah.
Which he will not name.
Chef's cut. All right. As long as they give me a cut, we're good.
Yeah, no, my favorite one's actually Old Trapper. That's really good stuff. But
okay.
Yeah, Pacific Gold's pretty solid.
I'll have to give that a try. I've never seen it. I'll order you some Chef's Cut. You order me some Old Trapper.
There you go.
Sounds like a plan.
We'll do a beef jerky exchange.
I like that. Because that's what we are, man.
Because that's the kind of friends we are.
That is exactly the kind of friends we are, man.
We'd send each other barbecue if we could.
I know. Well, you did actually for Christmas. You know, you sent me that.
That is true. That is true. I sent you some barbecue supplies.
Some rub and stuff like that. That was awesome, man. Rib rub and some chili mix.
I'd send you some ribs if I could, man. It's just
I would have loved that. Just falling off the bone, you know, ripe meat off the bone.
That's right.
Well, that was a digression.
Quite.
So Gandalf, after he's talking about this swift errand that turned into a massive digression, tasks Aragorn and the rest of the crew there with protection of Théoden and says, wait for me at Helm's Gate.
Yeah, and then he just takes off on Shadowfax with a description that I absolutely love.
Oh, I know. Yes.
I mean, just a flash of silver in the sunset, a shadow that fled.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Skeem tells us that at sunset, Gandalf leaves Host and rides on Shadowfax to Isengard, arrives at nightfall, stays only 20 minutes to speak to Treebeard, and then rides to help Verkenbrand.
Now, earlier we'd read from the Battles of the Fords of Isen, including the part that said, from there, this spot where Gandalf left the king, it was about 90 miles in a direct line to Isengard. Well, the maps agree with this distance. Hammond and Skull say that's true of both the original map and the revised map of 1980. But there's a conflict in a spot in the text that we're not really sure what to do with. In the next chapter, Gandalf says that it's about 15 leagues, that's 45 miles, from the mouth of the Deeping Coombe to Isengard, and even adds the extra detail that it's 5 leagues, or 15 miles, from the mouth of the Deeping Coombe to the fords, and 10 more leagues, or 30 miles, from there to the gates of Isengard. But that does not square at all with what we read at the beginning of this chapter regarding the distance from Edoras to the fords, if the map is correct. So keep that in mind. We'll explore that more when we get to Gandalf saying that in the next chapter. But in the meantime, if you want to send us your explanations or solutions, please feel free.
Please do.
Yeah.
Well, we see that when Shadowfax takes off, Snowmane actually wants to follow him. You know, I mean, again, Shadowfax is, you know, a leader of horses, right? Snowmane is like, I want to go too. But he couldn't, even if he was allowed to, because Shadowfax takes off so fast. He wouldn't have had a chance to catch up.
Not a chance at all. But then we get that brief chat that I thought was really interesting between Hama and that skeptical guard who seems to be channeling a little worm tongue, huh?
Very much channeling some worm tongue. I mean, basically it's worm tongue speaking with this dude's voice. I mean, it's like, oh, well, you know, if worm tongue was here, he'd have an explanation for this. I mean,
he sure would.
No, it really just makes you wonder how widespread worm tongue's influence has been. I mean, obviously there are guys here who were worm tongue sympathizers and may still be.
Definitely, and who are skeptical of Gandalf.
Yeah. At least we see Hama is firmly on Team Gandalf.
I know, I love
like
that.
That's really cool.
I do too. Even though he got taken in by the staff thing.
Yeah.
Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, yeah.
Maybe that's what did. He's like, oh, he got me with the staff thing. Yeah, that was pretty good.
One.
All right.
Good
You're
one.
All right with me, man.
I'm with you. Yeah, I'm on your side now.
But now we're finally on our way to Helm's Deep, and we're going to start with a little description of the place, aren't we?
Yes, we are, picking up partway through the next paragraph. Still some miles away, on the far side of the Westfold Vale, a great bay in the mountains, lay a green coombe, out of which a gorge opened in the hills. Men of that land called it Helm's Deep, after a hero of old wars who had made his refuge there. Ever steeper and narrower it wound inward from the north, under the shadow of the Threehirn, till the crow-haunted cliffs rose like mighty towers on either side, shutting out the light. At Helm's Gate, before the mouth of the deep, there was a heel of rock thrust outward by the northern cliff. There, upon its spur, stood high walls of ancient stone, and within them was a lofty tower. Men said that in the far-off days of the glory of Gondor, the Sea Kings had built here this fastness with the hands of giants. The Hornburg, it was called, for a trumpet sounded upon the tower, echoed in the deep behind, as if armies long forgotten were issuing to war from caves beneath the hills. A wall, too, the men of old had made from the Hornburg to the southern cliff, barring the entrance to the gorge. Beneath it, by a wide culvert, the deeping stream passed out. About the feet of the Hornrock it wound, and flowed then in a gully through the midst of a wide green gore, sloping gently down from Helm's Gate to Helm's Dyke. Thence it fell into the Deeping Coombe and out into the Westfold Vale. There in the Hornburg at Helm's Gate, Erkenbrand, master of Westfold on the borders of the Mark, now dwelt. As the days darkened with threat of war, being wise, he had repaired the wall and made the fastness strong.
That's good leadership right there.
It is, and as we'll see, it's incredibly good leadership. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of good leadership, Théoden, right away, follows Gandalf's advice. He knows. He trusts Gandalf now. And so he's like, you know what? All right, I'm going to do this. Turns to the south to ride to Helm's Deep.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk a little bit about Helm's Deep. I think first, the name is deceptive is the wrong word, but it kind of is. Helm's Deep refers to the canyon itself, not the fortress. Mm-hmm. and it's this deep valley that turns into a gorge and even a canyon deep into the Threehearn.
Yeah, and there is actually a lot of different nomenclature we need to talk about here, because there's a lot of parts to this area.
There really are. We'll kind of try to get this all cleared up for you.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us about Helm's Gate?
Okay, well, the fortress is Helm's Gate, and that itself is made up of multiple parts. There's the Hornburg, which is the main fortress, and the Deeping Wall, which closes off the gorge. So the Hornburg and the Deeping Wall constitute Helm's Gate. Mm-hmm. Now, the Hornburg is built on the Horn Rock. So hopefully you're keeping that all square.
So the Hornburg is on the Horn Rock.
Right. And then the Deeping Wall extends from the Horn Rock to the southern end. So simplify things. Picture an east-west running gorge with really steep sides. Now, that's not quite exact. It's not exactly east-west, but it's pretty close. Now, from the northern cliff on this east-west running gorge, there's a big piece of rock sticking out like a half circle. Now, build the Hornburg on that rock and run the Deeping Wall from the Hornburg south to the other side of the gorge, blocking off the part of the canyon behind. Now, we're going to see next episode that the Deeping Wall is really big. It's 20 feet tall, and it's thick enough that four men can walk abreast, so probably 12 to 16 feet wide.
Yeah, that probably makes sense.
Yeah.
And then there's the Deeping Stream, which is the stream that passes from the deepest part of the gorge under the Deeping Wall, and then it goes around the feet of the Horn Rock.
Yeah.
Then there's the causeway that goes up to the gates of the Hornburg, which actually crosses over the Deeping Stream. We don't actually read that until the next episode, but just while we're kind of painting the picture in your head, we want you to see that as well.
Exactly. Now, a lot of maps are available online, but really the best one is the one that's in Karen Fonstad's Atlas of Middle-earth. It gives a picture that really squares well with the text.
Yeah. Now, in addition to the fortress itself, there's also another defensive structure.
Yeah.
Which is easily forgotten about, actually.
Mm-hmm. For a good reason, we'll mention it in a minute. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is Helm's Dyke. Now, that's an earthwork defense. So basically, it's a trench with a defensive embankment.
Yeah.
And that's across a wider part of the valley, about a mile wide, and it's about a quarter of a mile below Helm's Gate.
Yeah.
So that's basically like an initial line of defense before you even get to the Hornburg and the Deeping Wall.
Right. Now, in fairness to the films, which got a lot of this chapter terribly, terribly wrong, they did seem to get most of the physical nature of the Hornburg, the Deeping Wall, the Deeping Stream, and even the causeway right. But we didn't see anything of Helm's Dyke.
Not at all. And I think that's one reason why it's easily forgotten.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to see how Tolkien envisioned this whole area, you can take a look at the Tolkien Gateway site. We'll actually include a link to that in the show notes for this. Mm-hmm. But there you'll see Tolkien's own artwork, Helm's Deep and the Hornburg, which is a sketch that really shows you what he's imagining with the valley coming up to the Sharp Canyon and guarded by this mighty fortress. So, again, check the show notes for that. We'll point you to it and you can see kind of what Tolkien has in his head as he's writing all this. Interesting thing about this place, it seems like this is built by the Numenoreans way back in their glory days, right?
That's right. Back in their sort of empire days, you know, as they were expanding here in this part of Middle Earth. And this line about the hands of giants really, really does bring to mind that phrase that we've used over and over again, Eld enter your work.
Yeah, I actually had the same thing in my notes. Everything about the description of this place reminds me of Eld enter your work. Everything about the description makes it clear that this is the stuff of legends for the Rohirrim.
Right. We get the legendary hero Helm.
Right.
And then the fact that it's built by the Numenoreans, apparently with help from giants, which honestly, that cannot be cheap labor.
That's a cool trick.
Their union drives a hard bargain.
Totally. Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And it's great because it's not enough that it was built by the Numenoreans and is Eld enter your work in that sense, you know, like that Roman ruins sense.
Right.
No. Their version of the story is that it's actually built by real giants.
Yeah.
That were apparently contracted by the Numenoreans.
That's right. Now, that's probably an exaggeration, of course, but it speaks to the awesomeness of this place in the eyes of the Rohirrim. Yeah.
Yep. Totally. But it is the full-time residence of the Master of Westfold, who we will find soon is an equally awesome guy, Erkenbrand.
Who, you know, I was thinking about this. He gets shorted in the films, in my opinion. The only guy who gets shorted more is Glorfindel.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think that's true.
I mean, I guess you could make a case for Tom Bombadil, who's completely shorted just like Erkenbrand. But really, Erkenbrand is key to this. And at least his part, you know, with he and Glorfindel, their parts got taken by other people.
Yeah. And Erkenbrand's part kind of gets taken by Éomer, which means that Éomer gets shorted because he doesn't get to show up at Helm's Deep, which is when he does some awesome stuff.
That's right. Exactly. So anyway, poor Erkenbrand. Yeah. But, you know, he's clearly a wise leader. He had wisely repaired the wall and made it strong, knowing that threat of war. And we'll see how very important it was that he did that.
Yep.
All right. Well, Sean, I'm going to have you pick up with the enemies in the valley, huh?
Yes, and I'm picking up just a couple of sentences after where you left off.
Mm-hmm.
Swiftly, a scout rode back and reported that wolf riders were abroad in the valley, and that a host of orcs and wild men were hurrying southward from the fords of Isen and seemed to be making for Helm's Deep. "We have found many of our folk lying slain as they fled thither," said the scout. "And we have met scattered companies going this way and that, leaderless. What has become of Erkenbrand none seem to know. It is likely that he will be overtaken ere he can reach Helm's Gate, if he has not already perished."
"Has aught been seen of Gandalf?" asked Théoden.
"Yes, lord. Many have seen an old man in white upon a horse, passing hither and thither over the plains like wind in the grass. Some thought he was Saruman. It is said that he went away ere nightfall towards Isengard. Some say also that Wormtongue was seen earlier, going northward with a company of orcs."
"It will go ill with Wormtongue, if Gandalf comes upon him," said Théoden. "Nonetheless, I miss now both my counselors, the old and the new. But in this need we have no better choice than to go on, as Gandalf said, to Helm's Gate, whether Erkenbrand be there or no. Is it known how great is the host that comes from the north?"
"It is very great," said the scout. "He that flies counts every foeman twice, yet I have spoken to stout-hearted men, and I do not doubt that the main strength of the enemy is many times as great as all that we have here."
"Then let us be swift," said Éomer. "Let us drive through such foes as are already between us and the fastness."
Good idea. Yeah.
Yeah, quite.
Well, smartly, because they're smart, they send scouts before they get fully into the coombe, who promptly get shot at.
Yeah.
Yeah, still was a good idea.
Yeah, they come back with some info. They find that there are some wolf riders there. There's a host of orcs. There are some wild men all headed to Helm's Deep.
That's right. They come back and they give the news and they say, "Many Bothans died to bring you this information."
Indeed. Indeed. So the scout reports, look, there's been chaos and confusion among the men. And by the way, nobody knows where Erkenbrand is.
No, no. And that's important. But there's a more important question. What about Gandalf?
Yeah, yeah. So they have actually seen him, or many have.
Well, yeah.
Like wind in the grass, but some of them are still mistaking him for Saruman.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I suppose, especially for any of those men that weren't...
haven't seen his new white look.
That's right. And the stuff at the top of the hill there, you know, the confrontation with Wormtongue after they came out of the hall.
Yeah.
Anybody who wasn't there for that, you know, might not know, especially if they were riding at the back since Gandalf was up in the van. And, of course, the scouts also report that some have seen Wormtongue heading north with orcs, because that's just who the guy hangs out with, which... And even with that news, Théoden says something really interesting. He's apparently desperate for some counsel, at least it seems that way, because he says he misses both of his counselors.
What? I know. That's an interesting line. And
it is.
I wonder about this. I meant, does he mean that he misses them in the modern sense of like, oh, they're not here and I wish they were here because, you know, I'm really happy when they're here? Or does he mean it like in the more neutral sense, which is actually the older sense of the word miss, of just like noticing their absence, feeling their absence?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, because you can say like, you know, oh, I walked into the restaurant and suddenly I'm, you know, I put my hand in my pocket and I missed my wallet, you know?
Right. Recognizing the absence of, or noticing
the absence
of.
Right, it's not like, oh, I miss my wallet so much. I mean,
oh,
it probably
wallet.
Is that soon after you realize it's gone.
Yeah, when you realize it's your wallet, you miss it that way, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I wondered, is it that he's just like, oh, I miss Wormtongue? I can't imagine that's what he means.
No, like, I
miss Wormtongue. I think it's just like, you know, I am missing both of my counselors.
That's a fair way of putting it, yeah.
I got nothing. It's like... I got nothing. Somebody counsel me, please.
I mean, if Wormtongue counseled me, at least I'd know to do the opposite.
Right?
Yeah.
Exactly. That's at least something to go on.
Right.
I got nothing here.
Nothing. Nothing at all. Cheryl, you got any advice? But he does agree that they need to go to the fortress, even if Erkenbrand isn't there. We have to use this as our defense. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then Théoden asks about the size of that main host that's coming from the north, right?
Mm-hmm. And he finds out that it's many times as great as what the Rohirrim have left. I love that line, though, about that, you know, fleeing. He that flies counts every foe twice. That's such a great line. But
that is a cool line.
Even with that overestimation, we know there are just a ton of orcs coming. Yeah.
10,000?
Yeah. That's huge. We don't know that it's that many, not in the books.
It is an army bred for a single purpose, to destroy the world of men.
Also not true.
I know. It's a cool scene in the movie.
I know, cool, but it's just not true. We'll get to that.
I know.
My goodness.
And I can't help but think of the appendices when it's revealed that, like, Aragorn is making jokes about action figures right before they shot that scene.
I know.
And so they, like, Bernard Hill and Viggo Mortensen are both just, like, trying to suppress laughter when they're delivering those lines. Anyway, I digress.
Oh, great stuff, though. I love that digression. So Éomer advises wisely, if we're going to do that, we got to move quickly. We need to get into the fortress right away. And hey, guess what? There are places to hide in there and maybe even escape from. Yeah.
And Théoden, who you would think would just be saying, like, finally, thank you. Somebody's counseling me. I appreciate that.
Right.
But no, he points out that, you know, he thinks those secret ways of escape might actually be known to Saruman.
Oh, yeah.
But he agrees it is probably the best place that they can hold in defense.
Yeah. There's no point in trying to get to the escape routes, but we should at least defend the Helm's Gate.
Right.
Even when a secret way of escape isn't directly known, it's not always safe. I mean, I couldn't help but think of the fall of Gondolin. We know that of that passage, the captains of Angband knew nothing and thought not that any fugitives would take a path towards the north and the highest parts of the mountains nighest to Angband. But they still got ambushed by orcs.
Yeah.
You know?
And a Balrog.
Well, yeah. Poor Glorfindel.
Because, you know, remember, again, another passage from that, Morgoth had set watchers all about the encircling hills.
Yeah.
You know, Saruman knows his history, and he knows this area. Théoden
sure
is right.
Yeah, Théoden is right, no doubt. They can definitely use this as a place to defend, but they're not going to be escaping from here.
Right.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and skip a little bit, and we're going to get to the rumor of war here. The rumor of war grew behind them. Now they could hear, borne over the dark, the sound of harsh singing. They had climbed far up into the deeping coombe when they looked back. Then they saw torches, countless points of fiery light upon the black fields behind, scattered like red flowers, or winding up from the lowlands in long, flickering lines. Here and there, a larger blaze leapt up.
"It is a great host and follows us hard," said Aragorn. "They bring fire," said Théoden, "and they are burning as they come. Rick cotton tree. This was a rich vale and had many homesteads. Alas for my folk. Would the day was here and we might ride down upon them like a storm out of the mountains," said Aragorn. "It grieves me to fly before them."
"We need not fly much further," said Éomer. "Not far ahead now lies Helm's Dyke, an ancient trench and rampart scored across the coombe, 2 furlongs below Helm's Gate. There we can turn and give battle."
"Nay, we are too few to defend the dike," said Théoden. "It is a mile long or more, and the breach in it is wide."
That's where we'll stop the reading. So.
All right. We skipped a little bit, didn't we?
Yeah, we did skip a little bit. So we're going to start at the beginning because I always love to start there. Aragorn and Legolas are with Éomer in the van. They're in the front.
In the van.
In
That's
the van,
right. They're
man.
In the van. It's painted green. Got the white horse airbrushed on the side.
Yes, it does.
They got Zeppelin's Immigrant Song cranking out the
Ooh.
Back. Wait. That's right.
Come from the land of the ice and snow, from the midnight sun and the hot springs glow.
Wait. But I'm afraid you're going to tell me it's not that kind of van, is it?
Probably not.
All
no,
right,
it's just the Vanguard. Short for Vanguard. Not,
yeah, I know. I know. But still, I can dream.
I know. I love the idea of a van with the green van with a white horse airbrushed on the side.
I mean, that's too perfect. That's
really
what
is.
I would have had as the Lord of the Mark.
I know.
If I had thought of it when I was a teenager.
If you had.
I can't pull it off at my age.
But actually, you might be able to. You could certainly go get an old beater van and paint it green and get a white horse.
I could.
You could. Get it
I could, but
on there.
My wife and children aren't going to want to be seen in it.
Your wife's not going to want you to be seen in it either.
No, for sure.
All right.
All right. No, not that kind of van, folks. Not that kind of wizard. Not that kind of ranger. Not that kind of van.
No. It's unfortunate.
But the night goes deeper, and they climb southward deeper into the gorge, sometimes coming upon orcs who flee before the riders can kill them.
Another tactical error on the part of Saruman's forces here.
There's a few of those.
We'll talk about that later. This, of course, leads Éomer to rightly say, whoever is leading the enemy, whether it's Saruman or a general of some kind, or at this point, frankly, a corporal, they're soon going to know if Theoden's coming to Helm's Deep.
Yep. And then we get to the passage that you read, starting with the sounds of war growing behind them, the rumor of war. But rumor here just means clamor or noise. It doesn't mean hearsay.
No, of course not. Oh, yeah. I hear there's a war coming. Did you know about the war?
My friend Becky told Grimble that there's a war coming. No, it's not that. It's
my cousin knows a guy who knows a guy who says there's a war coming. No.
Yeah. Not that kind of rumor.
Not that kind of rumor. not that kind of wizard. Not that kind of fan. Love it. Absolutely love it. Well, now we get, including the sounds of war, we get the harsh singing, which, you know, orcs, well, sure, why not? But let's not forget there are hillmen in here, too. So I think we might be hearing mostly them.
I wondered about that. You know, it goes back to that question of, like, do orcs subcreate anything, right? Do orcs write songs?
We know they did the poetry, and they did that song, you know, with the dwarves and the tree and all of that, the eyes popping and the skin melting.
The melting eyes and all that stuff.
I mean, just disgusting, but, you know.
But it's a song.
Yeah.
It's got a beat. You can dance to it.
It's not going to make the Eurovision finals, though, I'm pretty sure.
No, not quite.
So they look back into the veil and they, oh man, that's a no for me, dog. So they look back into the veil. They see countless torches and fires.
Yeah. And Aragorn observes that, look, it's a great host and they're pursuing them quickly.
Very quickly. Right. And then we get Theoden's comment here about Rick, Cot, and Tree. Now we covered Cot just a few episodes ago. It's the predecessor to the word cottage. It simply means a simple home. Mm-hmm. But Rick is new to us. I shouldn't have to explain tree, so I'm not.
I think we got that one.
We do. Rick is new to us. The OED tells us that a rick is a stack of hay or corn, especially one regularly built and thatched. So essentially, the army is burning everything in its path, even food, houses, and trees. They're just burning it all. It's very much Burninade in the countryside. This is Trogdor.
This is Trogdor.
On foot. Yeah.
Totally. This is the Trogdor High.
Yeah.
And Aragorn, he just wishes that it was daytime and they could actually turn and fight.
Yeah, yeah.
It grieves me to fly before them. It's like, man, oh,
it's just burning it up.
Bring him up. Yeah, it's like, I want to fight these guys.
I could take on 100 of these guys. Yeah.
Totally. But Eomer suggests, look, we could actually turn and fight at the dike, but Théoden reminds them that the dike is a mile long. They can't defend all of that.
We don't have the numbers for that. I mean, that's a big, big thing to defend. A mile in length.
Right.
You'd have to have 12,000 men, and even then you'd really only have, you know, a foot and a half between each person.
Right.
And
right.
No backup line.
Yeah.
So Eomer points out, though, look, our rear guard might have to do exactly that. Maybe not defend the dike, but at least defend the breach in it. Yeah.
Right.
And now they're going to get through the dike, and that's where I'm going to have you pick up. This is actually the last reading for tonight.
That's right. There was neither star nor moon when the riders came to the breach in the dike, where the stream from above passed out, and the road beside it ran down from the Hornburg. The rampart loomed suddenly before them, a high shadow beyond a dark pit. As they rode up, a sentinel challenged them. "The Lord of the Mawk rides to Helm's Gate," Eomer answered. "I, Eomer, son of Eomund, speak."
"This is good tidings beyond hope," said the sentinel. "Hasten, the enemy is on your heels."
The host passed through the breach and halted on the sloping sward above. They now learned to their joy that Erkenbrand had left many men to hold Helm's Gate, and more had since escaped thither.
"Maybe we have 1,000 fit to fight on foot," said Gamling, an old man, the leader of those that watched the dike. "But most of them have seen too many winters, as I have, or too few, as my son's son here. What news of Erkenbrand? Word came yesterday that he was retreating hither with all that is left of the best riders of Westfold, but he has not come."
"I fear that he will not come now," said Eomer. "Our scouts have gained no news of him, and the enemy fills all the valley behind us."
"I would that he had escaped," said Théoden. "He was a mighty man. In him lived again the valor of Helm the Hammerhand. But we cannot await him here. We must draw all our forces now behind the walls. Are you well stored? We bring little provision, for we rode forth to open battle, not to a siege."
"Behind us, in the caves of the deep, are 3 pots of the folk of Westfold, old and young, children and women," said Gamling. "But great store of food, and many beasts and their fodder have also been gathered there."
"That is well," said Eomer. "They are burning or despoiling all that is left in the vale."
"If they come to bargain for our goods at Helm's Gate, they will pay a high price," said Gamling.
"That they will. Oh, so much that we're going to be talking about in this. I know I said it's the last reading, and people are like, how could it possibly be the last reading? We're only so far into the episode. Oh, trust me.
Yeah.
We'll be here a while.
We got quite a bit.
We do. So let's start back with the breach in the dike that Theoden mentioned. This is not like a breach like somebody has breached the dike. This is an intentional opening. It's for the road and the stream, as we see.
Right. And now we see more clearly the nature of the kind of defense the dike is. It's a pit or trench in front of a high wall of some kind.
Yeah. And we've got an earthen defense, right? We've got the trench or dry moat, and then right. a wall of some kind, probably wood.
Yeah, probably. Mm-hmm. And then as they ride up, the group is challenged by the sentinel. Mm-hmm. Aemir says, Theoden's here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
by the way, I'm Aemir.
I'm here too.
I'm Aemir.
I love that. Yeah.
yeah.
And good tidings beyond hope. The king is here. That's awesome. But by the way, hurry up. Hurry up. Yeah. You've got enemies coming.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they get past the dike and they discover that though Erkenbrand isn't here, he's left a lot of men, and that is good.
That is good. And also some of the men who escaped from the second battle of the Fords of Isen have gathered there as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Gamelin gives the numbers. We have maybe 1,000 infantry.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do have a little bit more rapid-fire word nerdery on Gamling's name.
Good, I'm glad to hear it.
In the nomenclature, Tolkien explains it comes from gamal, old, mm-hmm. the normal word in Scandinavian languages, but only found in Old English in verse language. Hmm. So his name is basically a poetic word for old man.
It's another one of those, you know, Bywater or the hill or...
Yeah, right,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is just the old man, just like that guy was the Cheryl.
Yeah, Cheryl, you know, right.
This is the old man.
It's a very strange name for his parents to have given their child, so I wonder if this is more of a nickname or
an what a beautiful baby.
Kind.
What are you going to name him? I think we're going to name him
man.
Old man, you know?
So I'm thinking it's a nickname.
Probably, yeah. Either way, the fact that his name means old man means that he was way too young in the movies.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Bruce Hopkins, the actor who played him, is awesome. And he's been like a great presence in Tolkien fandom. I mean, he's super cool guy by all accounts. I've never met him
at a couple of the one.net parties. Yeah, super nice guy.
Super cool guy by every account I've ever heard. But
yeah,
I mean, I looked. He was the age I am now when those movies came out. And I am not a Gamling.
No, you are not.
I just want to point that out.
Wow. I don't even want to think about that. If he's was the age you are now.
Yeah.
What does that say? Yeah, I don't want to know. Well, speaking of too young, since he was too young, many of the infantry here are also too young or too old. So, you know, 1,000 infantry, but maybe half of those are really of fighting age. So it's a little bit of a trouble. But so, you know, next up, Theoden asks for word of Erkenbrand.
Yeah. And Aemir breaks the news that, look, we haven't seen him. We haven't heard any news of him. And by the way, the enemy's filling the valley behind us.
Yeah, so he's not coming now.
Theoden says something really interesting. I mean, he speaks very highly of him, says that in him lived the valor of Helm the Hammerhand.
That is high praise indeed. And,
absolutely.
You know, we talked about that warrior just a couple episodes back, and I love the little nod, right? It was named after this hero of old. He was quite the warrior.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, and the fact that Theoden is comparing Erkenbrand to him, that tells us that Erkenbrand is a pretty amazing guy.
Yeah.
And to me, it just underscores how everything associated with Helm's Deep is like something out of legend. You know, even Erkenbrand, the lord who currently holds this castle, is like, it's like this mythically great warrior. You know, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he really is.
But now Theoden is just thinking practically, like, look, we can't wait for him here at the dike. All of our forces need to be behind the walls because obviously.
Yeah, they're more defensible than a mile long trench and wooden wall. Right.
Right.
And so he asks then about a really good question, food and provisions. You know, we geared up to go out and ride to battle. We knew we were going to camp once, at most twice before we fought. So we mm-hmm. didn't come prepared for a siege.
Right. But fortunately, Gamling has some news for him. They've got plenty of food stored there.
Yeah, yeah.
They've also got animals and animal fodder.
Yeah, yeah.
And also many of the people of the Westfold. Now, mm-hmm. he says three parts. Does this mean like three parts out of four?
I think so.
I think that's what that means. Like, I mean,
better than three parts out of 100. That would not mean very
yeah,
many
that
people.
Would not be very encouraging.
I think so. Three out of four.
Yeah. I assume this means 75% of the people of the Westfold.
That does seem to be the way things break down, right? I mean, we talk about the Shire and the farthings of the Shire. I think, you know, we've got the cardinal directions. I can't help but think that this is three out of four.
That's what I think too. So
yeah.
If anybody can prove it or disprove it, let us know. But
yeah, please
that's what I'm going with.
But either way, it must be some decent news because nobody goes, oh my goodness, you only have 3% of the people.
Right, so, exactly. You know,
Éomer likes the news because the enemy is destroying the farms in the Vale, so we better have a lot of food and people here. Yeah.
Yeah. And then that leads us to this odd line from Gamling, which I ended on. If they come to bargain for goods at the gate, the orcs will pay a high price. I think we need to talk a little bit about what this means, don't we?
We do, and that's going to lead us to a humongous sidebar, not just on that one line, but on kind of this whole, well, the whole thing. Let's just put it that way.
The whole thing.
It's big. We're going to bring in an outside source that we've never used before, but it's one that we've had recommended to us numerous times before coming to this chapter. Brett Devereaux is an ancient historian. That is to say, he studies ancient history, not that he's old. Who frankly seems like our kind of guy. His blog, it's called A Collection of Unmitigated Pedantry, is absolutely stellar and really well worth looking into.
Yeah.
In preparation for this chapter, we read the 8-part blog series. It's some 4 hours worth of reading.
These are long blog
Very
articles.
Long. Each one is like a half hour read. So seriously, set aside 4 hours if you want to do this. Taking a look at the Battle of Helm's Deep from both the book and Jackson's film. It's an incredibly good read, and we are really happy to point you to it in our show notes. But just searching for A Collection of Unmitigated Pedantry will easily get you there.
Yeah, we will put it in our show notes, but just search for it. You'll find it.
Yeah.
It's a great read, and it's actually really funny, too.
It is. He's hilarious. That's what I'm saying. He's totally like us.
He's brilliant, and he's got all these references to sources, and yet it's incredibly accessible and funny. And while we could easily turn this into a discussion of every one of his 8 gloriously long posts. We're not going to do that because, first of all, we respect him too much to do that, and we want you to go read it. And secondly, a lot of his discussion is related to the film, and of course, we're looking at the book.
That's correct.
We did think that this interesting line from Gamling, which I guess a bit exaggerated too.
Yeah, it seems a little hyperbolic, doesn't it? Yeah.
A bit, yeah. But we thought it was a perfect opportunity to bring in some of Devereaux's expertise.
Yeah. Now, in talking about the obvious question, why bother assaulting Helm's Deep at all? Devereaux points out the modern error that since a fortress can't block the entire area, why don't we just bypass it and ignore it? There's nothing valuable there except the king, right? Well, let's go to Devereaux's blog for a good explanation of why Saruman has to attack this very, very easily defended place.
Yep. All right. So reading from Devereaux's blog, if Saruman's forces look to spread out to either pillage or, more likely, forage supplies locally, Théoden's army is a serious problem. Whereas Théoden's cavalry army can move fast with the supplies it can carry for the distances here, Saruman's force is on foot and has already been on the move for some time. Armies on foot moving with supplies are often quite slow. From Isengard to the ford of the Isen River is about 30 miles, and that's a 3-day march, before reaching Erkenbrand and defeating him on the second. So by the following day, they've likely been on the road for 4 days, or nights as the marching preference may be. And no, we ought not assume they move faster because of the Uruk-hai. For one, not all of them are Uruk-hai. There are men in Saruman's army too, the Wild Men of Dunland. An army of this size might carry something like 10 days' supplies with it, which means that Saruman's forces are rapidly nearing their operational tether. They have to either gather supplies locally, get supplies moved to them along secure supply lines, or turn back. If they want to stay in the area to secure it or do economic damage, they must begin foraging.
Yeah, orcs got to eat, right? I mean, they had nothing but maggoty bread for 3 stinking days, right?
Yeah.
Look, Devereaux is absolutely right. And I love the way he puts it. They are rapidly nearing their operational tether.
Yeah.
But foraging isn't a great idea with that 1,000-strong cavalry led by Théoden. Devereaux goes on to point out that Théoden, now safely based out of Helm's Deep, can use his cavalry to ascertain the disposition of the enemy infantry. And once he is satisfied they aren't concentrated for a battle, ride out and destroy the foraging parties in detail. Defeat in detail is the term for destroying a large army by engaging its separate parts in unequal contests one by one. In practice, the mere presence of Théoden's army prevents Saruman's army from foraging effectively. The threat of a cavalry attack will force the army to stay concentrated, which will prevent foraging, which will compel Saruman to retreat and try again, which he cannot do because, as mentioned, he is under tight time constraints.
Okay, so why not just go around?
Right.
I mean,
right.
Helm's Deep is not on the road to Edoras.
No, it doesn't block the way. You're right.
Right. Well, first of all, there's that operational tether issue that we already mentioned.
Yeah.
But then we get to another problem, supply lines. Devereaux writes, if the army disperses, Théoden can pick it off in detail as discussed. But if the army is to stay concentrated, it needs a source of supply.
Right.
Supplying an army over land in the pre-modern period is very hard. But the distances here are small enough that it is possible. But Theoden is once again the problem. His cavalry, stationed just off the road in Helm's Deep, could easily dash out, disrupt those supply lines, and dash back to the fortress before they could be engaged.
Now, even attacking Edoras is hopeless, he says, for the exact same reasons. Imagine Saruman's army now goes straight to Edoras, right? They leave Theoden's forces in Helm's Deep. They bypass them, along with the remains of Erkenbrand's army. They get to Edoras. Edoras is a walled city and require a typical siege. Well, now you've got something like 3,000 Rohirrim, including 1,000 cavalry, behind you, ready to arrive behind the siege works and destroy the host in the field.
And that is why Saruman has to take Helm's Deep. And by the way, no, it is not for the movie reason, which is to destroy the world of men.
No.
Now, sure, in theory, he could blockade it, but he doesn't have the time.
Right.
Saruman knows that Sauron is soon going to be attacking Gondor, and he has to be solidly in control of Rohan, and hopefully in possession of the One Ring by that time.
Right.
He doesn't have time to lay siege to Helm's Deep and starve them out, or even blockade them in and pillage the countryside.
Right. So burning the farms on the way in? Not smart. Killing the farmers? Also not smart. Operational tether, remember? Mm-hmm. So Gamling, who likely knows a bit of this inherently from years of conflict with the Dunlendings, is aware that the orcs are going to need food. They're going to need supplies.
Right. So he's basically saying, like, look, if they can't find supplies out there, if they were to come to us hoping to buy provisions from us because they burned everything, they're going to pay for it with their lives.
Yes, they will. But they're not going to come asking for it at the door. And Gamling knows that. But the point is that he gets...
Could we borrow some flour?
I just need
We're out of bread. We're out of maggoty bread.
That's right.
We need to borrow some flour and some maggots. Do you have any maggots?
I'd say flour without maggots, frankly, would be what I'd like. But these are orcs. But yeah, the point is that Gamling does get that there's a supply problem. He knows there's an issue here.
Yeah, and he says it with such style. I just can't argue with it.
No, of course not.
Now, we will come back to Brett Devereaux's blog, A Collection of Unmitigated Pedantry, a couple more times throughout these three episodes. But please check it out yourself if you're remotely interested in this stuff. You are going to love it.
You will. And not only will we come back to it in each of these three episodes, we'll come back to it again when we get to the Battle of Pelennor Fields because he did a six-part
yes,
study on
that. Yes, because
he
did the same thing there. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Now, behind us in the caves of the podcast, there is a great store of questions. So let's take a look and see what Barlaman has for us tonight. And after that, well, the talk still continues all night long at the Prancing Pony.
That's right. Our fantastic listener community keeps the conversation going in all our social media spaces. At our common room on Facebook, you'll find comments, questions, corrections, and more on every episode, as well as updates from us throughout the week. Just look for the Prancing Pony Podcast on Facebook.
And be sure to follow the page and join the group that we've recently created. The page lets us keep you up to date on the latest Prancing Pony podcast happenings, like the Moot. But the group gives you a great chance to discuss Tolkien with your fellow listeners.
And, of course, we also have some really good discussions going on over on Reddit. You can find us there at r/PrancingPonyPod. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, both with the handle at PrancingPonyPod. And if you're enjoying the show, please share us and consider giving us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Now, if you want exclusive content like postscripts, full bonus episodes, live Discord events with Sean and me, and episodes without digital ads, then check out patreon.com/prancingponypod, where you can support the show by joining the fellowship of the podcast. Now, let's see what messages Barlaman has brought us. Sean.
All right. Well, following up on our recent Tolkien Reading Day episode on Hope and Courage, and also the recent word nerdery on pity, our own Barlaman, Becca D., snuck this one into the bag.
Should we answer it? I don't know.
We should. It's a good one.
All right.
We absolutely should. Becca says, we know that Gandalf was a student of Nienna's, and that Faramir was a student of Gandalf's. How much of what he told Eowyn in the Houses of Healing do you think could be traced back to Nienna, especially pity being the gift of a gentle heart? There's also courage to be found in these lessons, the courage to carry on and rise up from grief. Eowyn has just lost a father figure for the second time in her life, and Faramir has now lost all of his immediate family.
True.
Still, he has hope, and he shares that hope with Eowyn, which brings them both healing. What do you guys think?
Well, I suppose the first thing we should do is look at the texts that Becca is referring to. First, from the Silmarillion in Valaquenta, we read that wisest of the Maiar was Olorin. He too dwelt in Lorien, but his ways took him often to the house of Nienna, and of her he learned pity and patience. But of Olorin, the Quenta does not speak, for though he loved the elves, he walked among them unseen, or in form as one of them, and they did not know whence came the fair visions or the promptings of wisdom that he put into their hearts. In later days, he was the friend of all the children of Ilúvatar and took pity on their sorrows, and those who listened to him awoke from despair and put away the imaginations of darkness.
I love that bit. Well, later, in Lord of the Rings, we read Faramir saying that he is able to read some of the ancient lore because, "I have had teaching. It was these records that brought the Grey Pilgrim to us. I first saw him when I was a child, and he has been twice or thrice since then."
And his father Denethor certainly knows that Faramir listened to Gandalf, as he has that heartbreaking line that he says to Faramir, "Boromir was loyal to me and no wizard's pupil." So yeah, Gandalf learned from Nienna, and Faramir certainly learned from Gandalf. But does that necessarily mean that Faramir's pity as the gift of a gentle heart somehow traces its way back to Nienna?
I confess that'd be nice. I rather like Nienna. I mean, okay, I don't invite her to parties because she's always crying, but I like her. And you know that I love Faramir. And the way he loves Eowyn with no hesitation, no expectation, it's such an amazing story. But I honestly think that Faramir's lines are maybe just a bit more reflective of his own noble and gentle character. He'd only met Gandalf 3 or 4 times total in his entire life. And at least one of those was when he was just a child. I've got to think that Gandalf's teaching would have been aimed more towards literacy in the older tongues, understanding the ancient Numenorean records, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely the kind of teaching that he got from Gandalf. I think that's all a valid interpretation of that. Although I would argue that, I mean, I think all pity, you know, the good kind of pity, traces right. its way back to Nienna in some way. I mean, the Valar do usually work indirectly by the influence of their, I guess you call them their domains, right, in Arda. And just as we talked about in season one, it was her sorrow that played such a key role in the third theme of Ilúvatar's music, the one when the children were envisioned. So
that's right.
I kind of think that Nienna is sort of the source of all pity in Arda anyway.
I can buy that. I mean, the notion that all noble pity comes at least in part from Nienna through the music. I'd go there. Because in Valaquenta, we also read, "She is acquainted with grief and mourns for every wound that Arda has suffered. So great was her sorrow as the music unfolded that her song turned to lamentation before its end, and the sound of mourning was woven into the themes of the world before it began." So, yeah, that's certainly an option, woven into the themes of the world.
Yeah, I think that tells us pretty clearly. I mean, it's pretty poetic, symbolic language, but
yeah.
I think it's pretty clear that what it's saying is that the reason that there is that kind of pity, that good pity, is because of Nienna. And so, yeah, it does trace its way back to her in some form, just maybe not necessarily through Gandalf. Yeah.
Right. I agree.
Now, I also really like what Becca says about the courage to carry on. You know, she points out that Eowyn has lost a father figure for the second time in her life, first her real father, and then Théoden.
I have lost a father figure.
Wow. George Michael.
Sorry.
Did not see that one coming.
Neither did I until I heard you say father figure. It just popped into my head.
Oh, man.
Sorry.
I haven't heard that song in forever. Wow.
That's okay. We won't hear it again if I have anything to say about it. Not a fan of the guy. I just don't like his stuff.
He's got a few good tunes. I was never like a huge fan, but he's got a few good ones. And I was a big Wham fan. So, well, I'm not a big Wham fan, but they had a few good ones.
We digress.
So Eowyn's lost her father figure, and Faramir has actually lost the last member of his immediate family.
That's true. Yeah.
But he still has hope, and he helps Eowyn find hope as well.
He does. And I like that. I like that a lot. But I should point out that I think Eowyn genuinely is, well, at least as upset about the older man that isn't her dead father figure as she is about Théoden.
If you're talking about the one I think you're talking about.
Yeah.
Emphatically not a father figure.
No, definitely not. I mean, if so, that's a whole other story. But
yeah,
we think that while she is sad about her father figure's passing, she's a little more upset about a different older guy.
About Aragorn. Yeah.
And I do think that the fact that the last remaining member of Faramir's immediate family to die recently did so in an attempt to kill him might make it a bit easier for Faramir to have hope despite the loss of his father.
I mean, yeah.
You know.
It's still his dad, you know.
Well, yeah, that's true. But I mean, look, I
love him warts and all.
Trying to be serious here, I'm not downplaying either the effect of Théoden's death on Eowyn, nor the fact that Faramir has now lost his brother and father in, and this is a little bit of a catch, but less than a 3-week span. There's so much story between those two moments, between the death of Boromir and when Denethor tries to drag Faramir onto the pyre. In 3 weeks, he's lost both of them. That's really, really
You're not
hard.
Kidding, and that's a good catch. I mean, it's easy to forget that only 3 weeks passed between Boromir and Denethor's death.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, looking at the dates, Boromir's killed on February 26th, and the Battle of the Pelennor is on March 15th.
I know. It does come pretty quickly. So
yeah.
Faramir has been through a lot of loss lately, and you know, not to mention the fact they both have experience with the Black Breath, though Eowyn much more closely, shall we say.
Sure.
But yeah, similar circumstances. Loss, sorrow, pain, the temptation to despair, but Faramir has hope, and he extends it to her, and she eventually chooses to accept it. And I love that moment. Oh, goosebumps. Yes.
Oh, yeah. That passage where it says that the heart of Eowyn changed, or else at last she understood it.
Oh.
And suddenly her winter passed and the sun shone on her.
Yeah.
Oh,
oh my heart. My heart.
I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
Just a few more years.
Just right. A few. I know.
Well, do we have time for one more question?
I think we do. Chris M. writes to us with this fun one. He talks about an episode way back in season one and says that you discussed the use of gnome, N-O-M, as a play on gnome, G-N-O-M-E, and how goblin and orc are used. He says, years ago when I first read Tolkien's works, I was honestly disappointed that gnomes and goblins weren't actual races. I thought the gnomes should be something between the dwarves and Tom Bombadil, and that the goblins would be a smaller but more cunning creature than the orcs.
Kind of like your traditional fantasy gnomes and goblins, sure.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Goblins, you know, I mean, orcs you have to get to when you're like level 4 or 5, but you know, you can take on the goblins when you're a little lower level. Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris goes on to say, now that I'm a little older, I can appreciate how Tolkien viewed and used these words. However, I was truly disappointed that he moved on from gnomes and goblins, and have always wished that these two races could have been included in the later text. It would have enriched the story more. Not that it isn't by far and away the greatest story ever written by mortal man, he says. Then he asks, what are some of your favorite might have beens from early versions of the Legendarium? And that's a fun one. Sean, what do you have?
Oh, this is a good one. And I probably have a bunch.
Yeah, yeah. One would be a challenge to come up with, but we'll do one
yeah,
each.
Yeah, the one that's coming to mind right now and was coming to mind as I was kind of thinking of this episode is the early frame narrative from the Book of Lost Tales. So if folks haven't read that, I mean, look, the Book of Lost Tales is weird. It's very different from the Silmarillion. So the frame narrative is that a mariner named Arial or Elfwina traveled to Tol Eressëa and spent time there with the elves. And they told him all the stories that would eventually become the Silmarillion.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that idea because it fits so well with Tolkien's idea that we still see in The Lord of the Rings, that Middle-earth is the prehistory of our world. But the Book of Lost Tales version takes it a step further by really leaning into that idea of a mythology for England, because Arial or Alfwina's sons were actually Hengist and Horsa, the legendary progenitors of the Anglo-Saxons.
Mm-hmm.
So it really was literally the prehistory of England.
Yeah, that's right.
But I especially love this idea because Tolkien went out of his way to include nods to the primary world to kind of underscore this idea that these were forgotten legends. So early on in the Book of Lost Tales, Volume 1, Arial says to his host, indeed, I would fain know who be these Valar. Are they the gods? And then his host Lindo says, so be they. Though concerning them, men tell many strange and garbled tales that are far from the truth, and many strange names they call them that you will not hear here. So basically what Tolkien's saying there very explicitly is that all the gods written of in the stories of men, all your Greek mythology, your Norse mythology, every other human mythology in the primary world are garbled versions of these real stories of the Valar that are remembered by the elves.
Yeah.
And that's just so cool to me. So there's also this bit from Volume 2 of the Book of Lost Tales where the elvish narrator telling Arial the story of the fall of Gondolin finishes it by saying, nor Babylon, nor Ninwi, nor the towers of Trui, nor all the many takings of Rum that is greatest among men saw such terror as fell that day upon Amon Gwareth in the kindred of the gnomes. And this is esteemed the worst work that Melko has yet thought of in the world.
Mm.
So in other words, the elf is telling him the fall of Gondolin was worse than the fall of Babylon, Nineveh, Troy, or Rome. And the narrator names all of these cities directly, or thinly disguised elvish versions of the real
Ninwi
names of these
instead
cities.
Of Nineveh,
yeah,
Trui
exactly.
Instead of
Trui
Troy,
instead of Troy,
Rome
instead of Rome. Yeah. So he's really tying the Book of Lost Tales story directly back to the history of our own world and the legendary history of our world.
Yeah.
Now, I don't really think Tolkien ever totally gave up on this idea. You can see echoes of it in, you know, stuff like the Red Book of Westmarch and even the character of Elendil, whose name means elf friend, same as Elfina. Yeah.
Right.
But I do wish that he had found some way to bring it back in and make it part of the official version of the story.
That would have been cool, no doubt. There are a lot of fun might have been. Like you said, it would have been really tough to narrow this down to one. But
yeah.
I'm going to step into a traditionally Sean area of the Legendarium and say that the story where Eärendil, or Eärendil as he was known then, kills Ungoliant is the story that I would have liked to have seen get full development. Though, of course, she wasn't always known as Ungoliant any more than Eärendil's name remained unchanged. Sometimes she's just the spider. In other drafts, she's Ungoliante or even Ungoliante or just Gloomweaver, which I like.
Right.
But we all know who she is. There's a very short prose version and almost a short verse version that I'll read real quickly. In The Shaping of Middle-earth, in the section on the earliest Silmarillion, we read the following. Wingolot he built, fairest of the ships of song, the foam flower. White were its timbers as the argent moon, golden were its oars, silver were its shrouds, its masts were crowned with jewels like stars. In the lay of Eärendil is many a thing sung of his adventures in the deep and in lands untrod, and in many seas and many isles, and most of how he fought and slew Ungoliant in the south, and her darkness perished, and light came to many places which had yet long been hid. Well, that lay of Eärendil is included in The Treason of Isengard, in a section called Bilbo's Song at Rivendell, and there we read, "From Ever-Even's lofty hills, where softly spill the fountains tall, he passed away, a wandering light, beyond the mighty mountain wall. And unto Ever-Night he came, and like a flaming star he fell, his javelins of diamond as fire into the darkness fell. Ungoliant abiding there, in spider lair her thread entwined, for endless years a gloom she spun, the sun and moon in web to wind. His sword was like a flashing light. As flashing bright he smote with it. He shore away her poisoned neb, her noisome webs he broke with it. Then shining as a risen star, from prison bars he sped away, and borne upon a blowing wind, on flowing wings he fled away." Love that.
Yeah.
And in fact, his accomplishment in killing Ungoliant was so great that in an early version of the story of his arrival in Valinor, it gets mentioned. And this version, which is from The Lost Road, which is Volume 5, it's Feonwë, son of Manwë, who greets him. And he says, "Hail, Eärendil, radiant star, messenger most fair. Hail, thou bearer of light before the sun and moon, the looked for that comest unawares, the longed for that comest beyond hope. Hail, splendor of the children of the world, slayer of the dark. Star of the sunset, hail, hail, herald of the morn." So yeah, I would like to live in a Middle Earth where Eärendil killed Ungoliant instead of her consuming herself, which, you know, really isn't appropriate.
It is. No, I do love the idea that Ungoliant ate herself, but yeah, I mean, you're right. Any version of the story that puts more notches in Eärendil's belt is okay with me. I mean, you know,
yeah.
Aside from, you know, his meager resume of earning the pardon of the Valar and slaying Ankalagon and becoming a planet, but you know, let's add Slayer of the Dark to that as well.
That's right. That's right. Well, folks, that finally wraps it up for another episode of the Prancing Pony Podcast. But please be sure to join us again next week when we finally draw swords together.
Guthwina for the Mark.
And Duril for the Dunedain.
Yes. Well, now, as always, we want to take a moment to thank some truly important people, our patrons at the Círdan's contribution tier. I'll start with Demay in Alaska, James in Virginia, Tamsin in Minnesota, Chad in Texas, Lance in New Jersey, Paul in Colorado, Jerry in Texas, Bruce in California, Mario in Utah, Seth in Texas, and Ella in California.
There's also Joseph in Texas, Kathy from North Carolina, Lori from Washington, Josh in Oklahoma, Carlos in California, Brian from the UK, Cameron in Nevada, Ned from Connecticut, Thad from Georgia, Jerry from Washington, and Nick from Wisconsin. Thank you all so very much for your support. And we also want to thank the team that helps make the show better. That includes our research assistants, Marilyn R. Pakila and Tanya Pleshkova, as well as our barlamen, Becca Davis, producer Jordan Rennells, social media manager Casey Hilsey, event and Patreon community coordinator Katie McKenna, and website guru Phil Dean.
This show would not be what it is without our supporters and our teammates, so thank you all. Now, be sure you don't miss any episodes of the Prancing Pony Podcast. Subscribe to the show through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
And one last thing as always, don't forget to send your thoughts, comments, and most of all, your negotiation tactics for besieging orcs to Barlaman@theprancingponypodcast.com.
Barlaman is a lot more reliable these days, but we get a lot of mail, so we'll get to you as soon as we can, and your question or comment may be featured on a future episode.
Now, as always, this has been far too short a time to spend amongst such excellent and admirable listeners, but until next time,
farewell, friends.